papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now you remember Mrs. Sadie Smugger.
The Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis where a little crew of veteran journalists try to give you some insight into newsroom decision-making and the ethical issues that confront contemporary journalism. I'm Rex Smith, formerly editor of the Times Union, now creating the Upstate American on Substack, and I have in the newsroom with me two of my colleague former editors, Judy Petrick, the former editor of the Daily Gazette of Schenectady, and Barbara Lombardo, formerly executive editor of the Saratogian and the Record of Troy. How are we today? What's on our minds?
You know, let's forget about 2025 and move on, you know? And I'd like to at least mention there's this interesting story out of India where there's a region where they have mandated by law that students spend 10 minutes a day reading the newspaper. And I love that story, even though, you know, long-term consequences are unknown. But I thought it's something to warm the cockles of this old newspaper editor's heart.
Well, we're glad that your cockles are warm. What are our cockles, anyway? Barbara, what's on your mind?
I like that one, Judy. I also would like to devote a little bit of time to talking about the letters to the editor in newspapers. Some places are starting to charge for letters to the editors if they are endorsing a candidate. What do you think about that? I'll tell you what I think.
What part of the country would do that?
All right, folks, the inside story is that's my home state of South Dakota they're talking about. I tell you, we get no respect, we Dakotans. So we will get to those topics. That's good. I'm interested in a little story that has broader significance, I think. I guess it's not a little story if you are from Minnesota, because the president wants to cut off federal aid to Minnesota because of fraud that's been discovered in, say, the federal welfare payments in Minnesota. Here's the issue about this thing. This got to be a big deal because of a 23-year-old MAGA influencer, a guy named Nick Shirley, who wrote on his blog, which has a couple million readers, I guess, that there was this fraud going on in Minnesota. And it fits in very nicely with Donald Trump's campaign against the Somali community, which is numerous in Minnesota. You know, Somalia has sent a lot of immigrants to Minnesota. And so once this got onto this young Nick Shirley's blog, J.D. Vance picked it up, the director of the FBI, Kash Patel, picked it up, and it has been amplified. Elon Musk picked it up, and so it has become an opportunity to be framed as emblematic of government waste, of democratic politics, of the failure of immigration, the mainstream media. Here's what concerns me about this. This story had been reported. KSTP Channel 5, which is an ABC affiliate, there's actually some really good investigative reporting. Historically, it's been done by the Minneapolis TV stations. They had reported this. CBS News had written about it. The Minnesota Star Tribune had written about this. It wasn't until it was picked up by an influencer, by a right-wing influencer, that the federal government jumped on it and made it a big deal. And now it has disrupted government services in Minnesota. And I just worry that that is what the current media ecosystem is becoming, that it's becoming something that is influenced entirely by individual folks who overwhelm the thoughtful analysis of things that is done by mainstream journalism.
I like how you called this person an influencer, not a journalist.
Well, yeah.
Because some people are calling him a journalist. Surely he's not a journalist.
His name is Shirley.
I understand.
We'll be here all week, folks.
Very impressive.
But it's true. It's the funnel of the news. I mean, I imagine, I would guess, I would put money on the fact that probably this kind of fraud happens in every state. And it is probably being covered by many news organizations. But the fact that this influencer decided to make a big deal of it And then the impact of it is significant for the poor people of Minnesota because the abuse has been amplified to an extent when people in the nation who look at the story think, oh, the only place this is a problem is Minnesota. It's real good news, real mainstream, regular news. And if an influencer picks it up, apparently under this administration, they will do something with it. I mean, we all have seen this before where our local newspapers will write a story and nothing is done with it. And then the New York Times will pick it up and then something will be done with it. The sad thing now is that this influencer is now the equivalent of what was once the New York Times to us.
Yeah, it is quite something. Maybe I'm just jealous because, you know, I publish on Substack and I have a few thousand readers, and he has garnered more than 116 million views of this video. Typically, Nick Shirley's MAGA universe has 1.2 million subscribers to his YouTube channel. I must be doing something wrong, right?
Well, when... Oh, no, Rex, you're not.
You need to do a video, apparently.
I guess.
This is painful, I think, because those of us who are disgusted by MAGA's misuse and the public's absorbing of this type of quote-unquote reporting, why isn't the mainstream media succeeding in getting that kind of coverage? Well, part of it is because this was a message that MAGA wanted to amplify, so it was really... Once the MAGA folks caught on to the way Shirley was presenting the message, they magnified it. So we in the normal media need to figure out if ABC's covering it and CBS is covering it, why isn't it catching on? Or do we just also feel bad with the way it's been catching on, is that the poor Somalians are being wrongly accused of, you know, being terrible people? I think that's what's making us sick to our stomachs. As news people, we're happy when media is exposing wrongdoing. We want that to be part of our job. But we feel sick the way that it's hurting Somalians.
Is there hope for mainstream media if we don't embrace these kinds of techniques? I mean, I guess what worries me is that people are increasingly buying into the storytelling mode of this kind of viral video. And we've been saying for years on this show that we need to develop storytelling techniques for mainstream media, for serious journalism, that will reach an audience that has grown up accustomed to a different kind of presentation. And I wonder if that's even possible.
I wonder whether or not the mainstream stories actually did their job and whether the catching on is just the amplification for propaganda purposes. Maybe the Minneapolis Star Tribune wrote a story and people are addressing the problem. People in Minnesota are looking at the system and finding out where the abuse is, and they're holding people to account. And what is happening with Mr. Shirley is just bad propaganda meant to inflame the MAGA base.
Right, he just throws the dirt.
But it does sort of remind you of, is it Gresham's Law that bad money will chase out good? That was always the notion that, you know, if you had a silver coin, eventually, if you start making coins out of nickel, the silver will be depleted in value. And I'm worried about this happening. I'm worried that this kind of junk food journalism is going to become the mode of the day.
And how do you even fight this? If you had an influencer that took an opposite position on it and tried to tell a story about how there's most Somalians are good people and are not committing fraud, you know, your eyes glaze over before I've even finished the sentence.
Yeah. Sorry, I was distracted there. I looked away.
See?
See? And so it is a concern. And while we're talking about the need to try to get a storytelling technique that will draw people in, let's get to that notion of what's being done for the school children in Uttar Pradesh, right? You said this is actually a hugely populous part of India.
Yeah. So it's a state in India that is, I believe, the most populous state in the world. Its population is about two-thirds the size of the United States' population. It's about 240 million people live in this state.
So a mandate that there must be 10 minutes of newspaper reading for students across all the basic and secondary schools in that state of 240 million people is a big deal. And, of course, you wonder how this could ever possibly be implemented in a country as divided as the United States, because the direction is that reputed and quality newspapers in both Hindi and English must be available in every school and library for there to be access. Boy, that would be a a dream back when we were doing newspapers and education programs, right?
Right. And for people who may not remember that, and it might still exist even, you had an option of donating to newspapers and education. If you're going on vacation, you could say, could we use your newspapers to go to schools so that students can be using that in the classroom? I think that's gone by the wayside, don't you?
Yes. Well, it became digital. Of course, as everything, as print went away, the notion was, well, we'll give free digital subscriptions to youngsters for use in schools. But I don't think that is still going on.
Well, most people are getting their news digitally. And I think that I read on this story that they were talking about trying to get kids off their screens. But why would you bring print newspapers into so many classrooms? It doesn't make economic sense to me, for one thing.
Barb. I mean, one of the beautiful things about the physical newspaper is the serendipitous nature of it. And putting a newspaper in the hands of a child, they can leaf through it and then they can discover stories that they may not have known about, or they can discover the comics, they could discover the crossword puzzle. I mean, I understand that it's a platform that's going away, but at a time when we're working so hard to get those kids off those screens, this seems beautiful to me. And one of the objectives here is to introduce them to words they may not be familiar with. I mean, that's one of the things about reading, that it teaches you to be familiar with new words and to look up words. So I see some value here. I understand. I don't think just giving them a subscription to the local newspaper and letting them check it out on their phone is the issue. I think wandering through the columns of a print newspaper is a wonderful thing.
Mm-hmm. I share your sense of wonderfulness.
But
I really, really do. But in reality, I think that maybe there's a strong newspaper lobby that made this happen in that state.
Yeah, can you imagine the number of newspapers are going to sell?
Right. And so in reality, though, you can accomplish most of those things by teaching news literacy using the way most people are going to be reading and are already reading the newspapers, and by showing them how to read the online version. And you can look up a word a lot more easily.
You know, one of the sad things that I learned about news literacy is the limited length of its impact. On this program 20 years ago, we were talking about news literacy, and I was the chair of news literacy for the American Society of Newspaper Editors, and actually traveled the country trying to convince college presidents to put news literacy into their curriculum, and spoke to educators around the country about how this would be a really great thing to add to your school curriculum. And I believe that's true. But what research funded by the Ford Foundation found is that the benefits of news literacy worked only as long as young people were relatively close in proximity to the time that they were getting the training. Once they were away from their news literacy classes, they fell off in their news consumption habits. And it was really hard to sustain the interest in the news that people had been given. I was very disappointed to see this research, because I really thought that news literacy was the key to building an informed electorate, to sustaining great journalism, the notion being that great journalism will survive only if there is an audience that can recognize it. I still hope for that, but it seems to suggest that unless you really make it a major part of the educational training year after year, it's going to fall away.
So where do you stand on this, Indian?
Well, I think it's terrific, but I'm kind of with Barb here. I would say, oh, well, print is past. Let's train them digitally. But I just don't think we can make this happen in the United States. Certainly, we can't do this in an era of the Trump administration when there is no sense of credibility or goodwill about real journalism, you know.
Yeah, that's making me think of the possibility of having a pilot program somewhere working with a school district to try this as an experiment, probably in digital. Maybe somebody's already doing that.
Well, the news literacy program in the United States, there's actually the news literacy project actually exists, and there are hundreds of schools around the country that do have news literacy programs, but they primarily work in private schools, not in public schools, because it's really hard to get public boards of education to allow time for this kind of thing in the schools. And the controversy, you know, boards of education are subject to voters, and there's a lot of pushback about journalism in the schools.
That's a shame, because there's so many opportunities and things that students are learning where looking at what's happening in the news or looking up past stories could be very informative It could be about space. It could be about science. It could be about health.
Absolutely. Anything. Great journalism really has so many ways that it can teach kids so many things, not just word of the day, as you were saying, but or words of the day, but you can teach so many subjects through the media. If you have thoughts on this, folks, media@wamc.org is how you can interact with us here on the Media Project. I'm Rex Smith here with Barbara Lombardo and Judy Patrick, and they're going to be telling you something negative about my home state of South Dakota.
Let's go, Barb.
How did this happen? What happened? There's a retired editor in South Dakota, right, who said nowadays people are actually paying to get their letters published in their newspapers?
He's advocating for this because what he's talking about are endorsement letters, and we've all seen them. They flood in like a week before an election where so-and-so endorses a candidate and extols their virtues in a, you know, systematic way. His argument is a lot of these are provided by the campaign, you know, probably they will be AI generated going forward, and that it's really not reflective of the populace. And, you know, why not charge for them? Just like we are charging for obits, weddings, engagements. I had never heard of this. I was stunned by it because, I mean, letters to the editor are among the most well-read pieces of content in a newspaper from where I stood. And the idea of charging people to express their opinion, I'm a little bit hesitant to do.
Let's pound another nail in newspapers' coffins. Why not? You know, I remember cringing when we switched the obituaries to being paid.
Yeah.
But I came to accept that for the main reason is that it gave people the opportunity to say what they wished in the obituary. So if mom is now joined dad or, you know, left peacefully.
Gone to that great bowling alley in the sky.
And yeah, so they could say whatever they want in whatever way they wish. And when we handled it as a news part of the paper, we had our own rules and standards, and it was cut and dried. And so it gave it more flavor, and I came to accept that. And then came the wedding announcements and the birth announcements and, you know, all the reasons that community people might want to look at the newspaper, they decided to charge.
To monetize it in order to get more money out of it. And so those things fell off the page, as a matter of fact. People decided
Facebook.
Because there are other ways to publicize a wedding, right?
Yeah, it was like, the heck with you, newspaper person. And now for letters to the editor, I totally get the idea that those are often, not always, but often organized by the campaigns. And that the letters are not truly written by the person who's signing them.
Of course. Didn't you use the term of stuff that is not actually written by ordinary folks, that's meant to look like grassroots? We called it AstroTurf. In fact, sometimes people would even fail to write in the letter the name. Instead of saying, dear editor of the Times Union, it would say, dear insert editor's name here. And you would get this AstroTurf stuff that was meant to look like it was a real letter to the editor. We would never publish those things if we could detect it. But often you can't detect it, right?
Yeah. And
if you start charging for them, the people with a lot of money are going to get a lot of space in your newspaper. I mean, if that's your motivation. And one of the things that I think we don't like is for money to be driving our campaign discourse to the extent that it is.
Well, this columnist's premise was that people who still read newspapers are people who tend to vote, so that they are engaged, and that smart candidates will still want to get their message across through the newspapers, whether it's digital or print. And following along that line of reasoning, then they should be advertising in the newspaper. And if they want to really get their words across, that they should be willing to pay for letters.
Yeah, good luck with that, trying to sell newspaper advertising for political campaigns.
Yeah, because the flip side of it is that newspapers have become one of the weakest ways to reach voters.
She said candidly.
Sorry to say.
Right, and I guess you could buy a display ad if you want to put a letter to the editor and put your endorsement in there. Let's just hope that we haven't planted any seeds in any local newspapers about starting to charge for these letters. I am sorry I brought it up.
By the way,
wait a minute, Barb brought it up.
You called that story to my attention, and I fell for it.
By the way, I was surprised to read in this piece from a retired South Dakota newspaper editor, a guy named Dana Hess. I was surprised to read that there are still such things as politicians' weekly columns that newspapers publish. I used to write one of those when I was a congressional press secretary.
You're clearly not reading
20s.
The Saratogian.
Is that right? Politicians' columns. What
Wait a minute, you used to write one. Were you in office at some point?
No, I was a press
he
secretary
was the ghost
for
writer.
A congressman. Yes, right.
Those guys don't write those? I'm so naive.
Yeah, imagine that.
Yes, well, that's actually an interesting little dilemma, because a small newspaper kind of welcomed the opportunity to have the local or state politicians. We would give them a place once a month or whatever it might have been, where they could say what a great job they're doing. And I kind of welcomed it with a sinking feeling in my stomach anyway, because one, if we were writing critical stories about the politicians, we can also say, well, we're giving them a chance to say whatever they want to say. And I also feel for politicians, you might have some of this sentiment, Rex, that sometimes politicians are trying to do the right thing and they are having trouble getting their messages across to the public. So I think that's legitimately true at times. And the last thing was, it filled space.
Back when we had a lot of space, but nowadays that is not the
issue. We never had a lot of space, but yeah. Then we had more space when we had fewer ads.
But it's very hard to find anything that is genuine in the communication from the political world. You know, you look at the mail that you get that is funded by taxpayers generally, which looks just like advertising. And this is true on the state level, it's true on the federal level. Even though there are guidelines, you know, there's a franking commission in Congress that determines whether a piece of mail meets the federal regulations for taxpayer support. And so they count the number of photographs of the member of Congress, for example, that can go out in a piece of literature that carries taxpayer funding through the mail. And you have to be careful about the language, supposedly. But honest to goodness, I never...
I think that's out the window.
It's
if ridiculous.
If
it ever happened.
Yeah, it's very much promotional, I have to say. Even that was so 50 years ago when I was writing this stuff for a member of Congress from a different part of the country.
And, you know, if you're giving the local state assembly person or a state senator a chance to say something in the press, that does open the door for unpaid responses that people can say, well, this was a lot of baloney that so-and-so wrote. And the newspaper, if they're still writing editorials, can say, you know, contrary to so-and-so's claim of blah, 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 they actually voted against that legislation that they're touting as being so great or whatever.
Right. Anyway, as we draw down to the last few minutes of this, I think we need to take just a quick look back at last year, at 2025, because this is our first show of the new, hopeful new year. And just a couple of interesting facts that we might want to cite to think about where we are. The U.S., out of the 180 countries in the World Press Freedom Index, the United States is currently ranked 57th in domestic press freedom conditions. Isn't that amazing? It's the lowest ranking the U.S. has ever received, behind Sierra Leone, Romania, Liberia. Press freedom in America is definitely under attack, right? And we have to hope and work to move forward, I would say. And this is a nation that, you know, has over the past last year cut out more than $1 billion that used to go to public broadcasting, where the president is suing newspapers and other media organizations. Press freedom is definitely under attack in the United States.
One of the cases I'm really looking at and following with a heavy heart is Mario Guevara, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, from El Salvador. He moved from El Salvador under threats of violence in 2004. So he's been in this country for more than 20 years. He had a work visa. He has a family here. And he was covering things that were critical of the administration. And he was detained and put in solitary confinement for like 3 months or so. And now he's been deported back to El Salvador, where he tried to get away from in the first place. It's like one example that the public can follow, and there's others as well, that this is really frightening, that citizens and non-citizens alike are undeservedly being detained and deported. And in the world of journalism, this is an example of why we should all be worried, all meaning all people.
Yeah, but don't look away. The people that own these companies need to stand up. The retired journalists like us need to stand up. Journalists need to stand up. And the people need to stand up. I mean, you need to support your local newspaper. And when you see abuses happening, you need to step forth and support journalism, because we are there for you.
And on that point, I think we're going to let that be the last word for this first show of 2026, with high hopes that it will be a better year for press freedom, as Americans begin to realize what has been lost and what is being challenged in this new Trump administration. That's the media project for today. Barbara Lombardo, Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith, with gratitude to the producer of the media project, David Gustina, and to you folks for joining us. We hope to hear you. We hope you will hear us again next week. We hope you'll come back to join us for the media project.
Tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild. Got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill. All together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Sadie Smuggery.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, former vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, and Barbara Lombardo, adjunct professor at the University at Albany and former editor of the Saratogian. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
The test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. Like the richest girl who could not bake a cake. Ding-a-ling, ding-a-ling, ling-a-ling, ling. Now, newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild. Got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill. All together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now, publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give 3 cheers for freedom of the press.